All right. Welcome to another episode of Pivot Play. I created this podcast to bring inspirational stories of struggles and persistence for those who dare to dream and pivot until they find success and fulfillment. I hope these stories can motivate us to find the courage to step into our next pivot in both our professional and personal accomplishments. I'm your host, Adi Chandra, and it's my pleasure to introduce our guest today. Sean Azizi is an accomplished aviator who have flown for different carriers over the past 8 years. I first met Sean in the spring of 2023, and we both share a passion in aviation with my background in aircraft interiors, program management, and Sean's as a pilot. I've always been curious to know what life as a pilot is like, and I'm so glad to have the opportunity to speak one today. Welcome to the podcast, Sean.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
How's life as a pilot these days?
It's pretty good. Can't complain. It's either a lot of time at home or a lot of time away from home, so it's kind of hard to find that balance, but it's been good.
That's the only constant, as you know, whether you're a pilot, 50 years ago, or you're a pilot in 2024.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the sacrifice you have to make, right?
Exactly.
Being away from family when you're at work.
Yeah.
But before we get into that, we haven't talked about, your early days, your youth, your childhood.
Yeah.
Maybe share a little bit about What was your childhood like, and what were you like as a kid?
So I like to think I grew up a pretty normal life, but it's tough to say. I have immigrant parents who both immigrated from different countries, mm-hmm. and eventually made their way from this from the East Coast in New York,
okay.
To California, and they decided to have a family. So grew up in a bit of a diverse household because my parents came from different countries,
right?
But they did their best to provide for their children, and they did a great job at it. And, early on, I was always kind of into cars and motorcycles and BMX bikes and things like that. So I rode BMX bikes for a very long time. Yeah.
Man.
Okay. So I used to, catch the train out to Arcadia or Baldwin Park, West Covina from LA all the time to go ride at skate parks and go home.
Wow.
Those were probably my bigger passions, BMX and cars.
Okay.
So I've always been into that.
Did you ever break a limb or something?
Yeah, a couple.
Okay, pretty bad, or just like,
kind of. In BMX, I've broken, fingers, nose, toes, wrists.
Okay. Wow.
Things like that.
Okay.
Feet. I was in a pretty good motorcycle accident a number of years back, and I broke my femur.
Wow.
So that was a pretty good recovery as well. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
How long did it take to kind of fully recover?
The femur was about a 2-year recovery. It was a compound fracture, so my bone broke in half and protruded out of my leg.
That's what a compound fracture means?
Yeah.
Oh.
So you can have a fracture where it's just like a hairline crack.
Right.
And a compound is when it breaks completely and exits the body.
Like complete break, basically.
Yeah. So okay. Now I have a metal rod in my leg. They drilled my femur hollow, put a metal rod in it, a couple of screws.
Okay. Good as new.
Pretty much, yeah.
Or better.
Probably better. Titanium is pretty strong nowadays. So.
Wow.
It was a pretty expensive leg, let's say that.
Yeah, I can imagine. Okay, so you did that. By the way, do you have any siblings?
Yeah, I have an older brother, and I actually have a twin sister.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Wow, okay.
So my brother's a couple years older than us, and I'm the older of the twins.
Okay.
I have a little sister, I should say.
But okay.
Yeah, we're twins.
Ah, interesting. Didn't know that.
Yeah.
So, okay. So you had a lot of interest in BMX, cars in your younger days. I mean, if you look back, when was the first time you thought you might want to become a pilot?
So that actually happened a lot later on in life.
Oh, okay.
I would say, when I was younger in school, like grade school.
Right.
The idea of like becoming a doctor or a pilot is like the equivalent of being an astronaut in my eyes,
It's like too far-fetched.
Exactly. It just seemed unattainable.
Okay.
And I think also part of it was, you come from, I'm first generation here in my family, and there's nobody else to rely on for information on how to go about doing certain things or pursuing certain careers. So I just never imagined that it was feasible for me.
Mm.
And I have a close friend of mine that actually I went to high school with, and we got back in touch years later. I had a lot of personal things going on in my life, and I was ready for a change. And, catching up with him and realizing that he's an airline pilot at the time, he still is, but he was at the time, it sparked my interest. And we stayed in contact after that. And fortunately, he helped pave the way for me to become an airline pilot.
So that was kind of the first time that you even thought about it. Like you even imagine yourself going through it, right?
Yeah.
And going through the process of becoming one. Okay, but before that, you know, say you're still in elementary school, what were some of the things that you thought you're going to become when you were at that age?
Something that I was dead set on was getting to automotive fabrication. Because cars have always been a passion of mine.
Like mod kits and stuff, or what kind?
I just love to build and race cars.
Okay.
That's still probably one of my biggest passions today.
Like Irwindale Speedway kind of thing.
Yeah. I can appreciate all disciplines of the automotive industry, so I can't pick just one. Like, I love, you know, drifting, drag racing, Formula One, all that stuff piques my interest.
Okay.
But I wanted to build, you know, and whether that be like a street car with an engine swap, or just, you know, modifying a car to handle better and take it to up to like Willow Raceway up in Rosemont and all that.
But you were into the racing part of it, not just the building, but racing as well?
Both, yeah.
Both. Did you ever do it or try?
Yeah, I've done a number of track days. Okay. It's been a couple of years since I have, but I think, yeah, I've always loved, like, you know, street driving and street cars too. But once you take a car on a racetrack and you learn that the car is so much more capable than you thought, street driving becomes boring. And racetracks are where things are at. So, that's always really opened up your eyes to, like, understanding why cars are built and designed the way they are. And then you go off into, you know, why your, you know, 90s Japanese car operates this way, and why, you know, like, a Corvette Z06 is so well engineered for what it is, or the German stuff. And, you know, so it makes you appreciate all aspects of automotive.
It's funny you mentioned, because recently we had a movie night. Okay. It was Gran Turismo.
Yeah.
Did you watch that one?
I did, yeah.
Wasn't that amazing?
It is.
Like, it's one of those movies that are, I don't know. I mean, you know, every movie is staged, right?
Yeah.
But it's got some, like, real physics behind it. It's got, I mean, it's like based on a real story, on a true story.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So I never got into, when I was younger, I did play video games a little bit.
Yeah.
And Gran Turismo was my go-to game. So when the movie came out, I didn't see it till it you know, was on a streaming device and we watched it.
Yeah.
And it brought back a lot of memories, because that was the only game I ever played as a kid that grabbed my attention. So I played a lot of Gran Turismo growing up.
And that's probably why you thought of doing that.
Yeah.
For real.
Yeah.
Like, right, as a grown up.
Yeah. And that was the other part too. Like, you know, you talk about my interest when I was younger. Like, I never had the idea that being a race car driver was an option. I look back now and that would be amazing. Obviously, it requires a lot of attention to detail, a lot of work involved to make that happen, but it's feasible. You know, as I get older now, I realize it's kind of corny to say, but like, anything's possible.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You just have to set your mind to it and dedicate for it. But it just seems so far-fetched for me.
It's funny that sometimes kids have that imagination, and when they were younger, they think anything is possible. But then there are also some of us who think, like, hey, if I look back, and at that time, I didn't think I was able to do it, but then I was able to do it.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like, yeah, sometimes kids' imagination is great, but sometimes, you know, the benefit of age and human wisdom, as you look back, you know, you thought, like, hey, if I had done something different, maybe I would have made it. Maybe I would have reached, you know, a certain goal that I thought wouldn't be possible.
Yeah.
And I guess, I mean, if you pass it down, you know, to the next generation.
Well, you know, it's like when you're younger, like you said, anything is possible, because you don't know left and right, right from wrong. You don't know any of that. So in your eyes, everything is possible. And unfortunately, it seems like, you know, our obstacles aren't intentional, but it could be parents saying, oh, you're crazy, think you're going to be a race car driver.
Exactly.
Or, I don't want you to get hurt and all that. But it's like, you know, our dreams get shot down before we even realize that they could be dreams sometimes.
Right, right. Yeah, like that kid in Gran Turismo.
Exactly.
It almost seems like I was watching fiction.
Yeah.
Because, you know, how does an esports, you know, driver,
mm-hmm.
I mean, he was literally an esports driver, but he was like one of the best, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he knows the game like inside out because of, I don't know how many thousands of driving hours he had on it.
Yeah.
And then he made it. and it almost felt like, yeah, that's so Hollywood.
Yeah.
But it happened.
Exactly. And ironically enough, there's a lot of that correlation in that movie to what I do. You know, like we do a lot of our training in simulators.
Right.
So for us, you know, we can have simulators that are full motion, that move in every direction an airplane would, and it comes really close to mimicking an actual aircraft. Mm. You know, is it 100%? No. But it does a very good job, enough to where we get signed off to actually fly a real aircraft after we have X amount of hours in a simulator, and we perform certain maneuvers that we need to show that we're proficient in. Yeah. So there's a lot of similarities there, you know? True. So it's kind of funny to think about.
Like a PlayStation game is a simulator.
Exactly.
The real thing.
And if you go on YouTube, there are tons of videos of, you know, people who fly like Microsoft Flight Simulator and things like that. And then it's like, oh, can I land a real airplane?
Wow.
So, yeah.
Okay. So what was okay, we talked a little bit about your background, but what was your first paying job?
My first paying job... I grew up in a small family business,
okay.
So I helped out a lot.
Yeah,
you know, ever since it was like almost like slave labor as a child. You know, it was free work. But I did that for a number of years working with my father. Outside of like a family business, though,
mm-hmm.
I worked retail at a store called Tilly's, the clothing store.
Okay, I remember that.
Yeah, I worked there for a bit, and actually enjoyed the retail experience. It was kind of hectic, but it was fun.
Just as a assistant?
Yeah, just an assistant, you know, cashier work, things like that, stock, you know, everything from cleaning the store to organizing the store.
Right.
Yeah, I did that for a number of years just to get some work experience and kind of see how I liked it, what else was out there.
Okay.
But growing up in a small family business was a different experience in its own, you know, always understanding how we had food on the table from our parents.
Yeah.
And what kind of work ethic was required to have a successful business.
Right. What was that like for you? I mean, did you enjoy it? I mean, and maybe share a little bit about what you did.
You know, I'm very fortunate for it. It was, you know, when you're a kid, you don't know what normal is.
Right.
You know, 'cause everybody lives a different life and you figure that out later. Sure. So I thought it was normal to, you know, get picked up from school and then, you know, you're going straight to your parents' work because they have to work and find a way to provide for you. So work was our life. You know, that's what we did. It was awesome working with close friends and family. Mm. You know, it didn't feel like a job in a way.
Okay.
It was more, I'm supporting the family. I mean, it's tough to say. I've never had a 9-to-5 where I felt like, oh, I'm at work. This is a drag. I don't enjoy it.
You've never had that? Hardly.
Not really. Yeah. But you know, I haven't had the average work experience that most people have, you know, going from working in a family business, branching off to kind of starting my own business within that family business, and then getting into aviation. Aviation is not a typical 9-to-5.
Absolutely not.
You know, so, you know, I talk to a lot of people that dread going to work.
Right.
And, I can see why, but yeah, my father started a small office supply company when he moved to California. Kind of like, you ever see the TV show The Office?
Yep.
I'd like to say that's kind of the story of my life.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. How long did you do that for before you had to do something else?
Doing that full time, I would say it was probably from 18 to 26, about 8 years.
Okay.
At least.
That's quite a bit.
Yeah. And then, within that, I started my own company off to the side. I want to say about 4 or 5 years.
Okay.
As well. So I kind of branched off into, becoming a printer technician and servicing, printers.
Right. Yeah. So let me ask you this, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
You were enthused about racing and automotive and things like that. At what point did you think that wasn't attainable for you, or do you try to go in that direction and hit some wall?
You know, I never thought it was attainable up until like the last couple of years of my life, where I'm like, now that I look back, I could have done anything I wanted.
Right.
But I would say that dream of the automotive world never ended, because every dollar I was making at work, I was spending on a car.
Really?
Yeah. So not that I'd recommend it, but
it became kind of like a hobby for you.
100%. It was a lifestyle. It wasn't even a hobby.
Right. Lifestyle.
You know, I was working to help save money to build an engine for a car, or you know, things like that, or redo suspension or things like that. So it was kind of like, I guess, my relief or my side gig.
Okay.
So although I never got into like anywhere close to like, you know, professional racing or anything like that, that filled the void of the automotive industry for me. Because if I wasn't at work, I was working on a car, I was driving a car, you know, I was going to events, I'd go to the racetrack, things like that.
So you still do that? I mean, you still...
Not as much now, unfortunately, but
I'm... used to kind of build up your own car and...
Yeah, 100%. Track, yeah.
Do some track events.
I got into airplanes to pay for my car habit. That's what I like to say.
That seems like a good trade.
Yeah, it's working out so far. I mean,
both are pretty fun.
Yeah.
So, take us through... Okay, so you met a friend. He was a pilot. Mm-hmm. Still is a pilot. He kind of inspired you to peek into that world of aviation.
Yeah.
What was that like for you? Like, was that just like one day you meet him, it struck a conversation, and what you heard from him just completely piqued your interest and you start to dig into it? Or was that like kind of like things going through your head and saying, you know, and you were kind of asking yourself, can I do it? Should I do it? What was that process like for you?
You know, I'll be honest, it was kind of scary. I was in my mid 20s, and you know, when you're younger, you think, you know, you're old. And as you get older, you're like, you start kind of looking back, but I was like, oh, I'm too old for a career change. Like everything's fine now. You know, you're very comfortable. But I was also at a point in my life where, I was ready for a change. You know, there's a lot going on in my personal life, and it was forcing me to grow.
Okay.
And so I was ready for a change, and I was looking elsewhere for some form of employment that I can enjoy for the next 30, 40 years. So
why did you think that flying an airplane was going to be interesting for you?
I thought I had a lot of similarities to cars and motorcycles. You know, there's speed involved, aerodynamics involved, and all that. So it sparked my interest. And I like to build cars, and airplanes have a lot in common.
Hmm.
So,
did you ever think about maybe going the military route? The next Top Gun?
I should have done that. I should have done that sooner. okay. Now that I look back, I probably, if I can redo it again...
you might want to.
Consider joining the military,
right?
If I was younger, but also, you know, when I was in high school and like outside of high school, we were in wars left and right in the Middle East, and that didn't seem fun, right? Flying an airplane seems fun. Flying a fighter jet is like top notch, but you know, when you're at war with somebody, it doesn't seem like something you want to be involved in. So,
yeah.
I guess that kind of deterred me from it. But I like the discipline that the military provides in your personal life. And it gives you those kinds of opportunities. So I didn't join the military, didn't take the military route. I know a lot of people that do and enjoyed it. They have amazing stories.
Right.
But, you know,
it could be a sacrifice.
A very big sacrifice. Right? The ultimate sacrifice.
I mean, there's a senator, I think Senator Tammy Duckworth. She was, I believe she was a Black Hawk helicopter.
Okay.
Pilot.
Yeah.
And she was injured in a battle for Fallujah. In Afghanistan.
Wow.
And it was in the 2000s. So
yeah.
She lost both legs.
Yeah.
And I mean, like, it's a sacrifice. It's not all just the...
It's not all fun games.
Stories and glories, you know?
Exactly. Right? Exactly.
Okay. So you thought, okay, maybe if you were younger, you might have gone that route.
No, and this is me looking back now older and more experienced, fair enough, you know, on paper.
Yeah.
You know, now that I look back at it, I'd like to say that I have some clarity and sense of direction. When I was younger, I didn't have as much direction as I have now.
Hmm.
And I think that's just, you know, kind of finding out what I wanted. But like I said, I didn't have, you know, aunts and uncles or cousins that already went to college in the United States and like, oh, this is how you go to college. This is how you do, you know, I didn't have that direction. For me, it was like, okay, you got to graduate high school. Okay, you got to go to college. It's like, okay, but what am I going for?
Right.
You know what I mean? Yeah. And obviously, that's kind of a hard question to answer. That's the million-dollar question in life, is what I want to do for the rest of my life. But if you can figure that out younger and, you know, realize that there are means of achieving those goals, like being a race car driver, airline pilot, it helps. If you don't have that sense of direction, you're like, okay, I'm going to go to school and get my GEDs. It's like, okay, what are you going to do with your GEDs? Oh, I'm going to get a degree in communications. What are you going to do with that? You know?
A lot of teens Even college kids, they don't know what they want to do.
Yeah.
I didn't know what I wanted to do when I was in college. I mean, I was already in college. I made it to college.
Yeah.
But I didn't know what I wanted to do.
So if you don't mind me asking, what you're doing now, does that have any correlation to what you were studying in college?
A little bit.
A little bit, but not what you expected.
No. Yeah. I studied industrial engineering. So industrial engineering is very general.
Okay.
To me, it's like GED engineering.
Okay.
Because in industrial engineering, you learn how to improve your process.
Yeah.
So whether it's a McDonald's, kitchen process or managing an airport, you need industrial engineers to kind of help map out what's good and bad about your current state process. And then what do you want in the future? What do you want? How do you want to improve it?
Okay.
So then you kind of figure out the bridge between the current state and the future state. That's all industrial engineers do.
Got it.
So a lot of industrial engineers, you know, they work for a whole variety of companies, right? So I started in an aerospace supplier company that makes aircraft interiors. My first job was as an industrial engineer was to figure out the production line.
Got it.
Where are some of the hiccups? Where are some of the, processes that are broken? How long does it take for us to make a closet, a galley? And what can we do to go faster, a little bit faster?
Yeah.
Make the process more predictable.
Yeah.
So I would be like going down to the production floor, figuring out what the process steps are, figuring out how people make stuff, and just trying to make it a little bit easier for them so that they have an easier job and, you know, more success in what they do.
Yeah.
But I only did that for a couple of years.
Okay.
And I went into project management. So like I said, 2 years, and then the rest of the benefit I would say is just how you deal with people, how you work in teams, how you, you know, work to achieve a common goal. But those things can be accomplished with any education.
Yeah.
I mean, I would say that.
Yeah. And a lot of it too is experience on the job that you learn. I think college is a great tool. You learn a lot about yourself. You realize that you can achieve goals of getting a college degree in 4 years, whatever it may be. But at the end of the day, you know, you go to college to get a piece of paper saying, hey, I can achieve this. And right. then you get a job, right?
Right.
And then whatever field you get into, you learn more on the job than kind of what college was teaching you. But
100%.
You know, yeah. So there's a lot of that.
There's a lot of that. And it's almost like, you know, you wear the cape and you graduated and that was like a confidence building thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I felt like, yeah, okay, I did this, so I should be able to get my next, you know, leg in my career or exactly. whatever in life.
Yeah.
And accomplish something.
It gives you a great block to build off of.
But that's just one path.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of people these days, they're starting to see whether that's the right path for them.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And you know, there's no right or wrong answer. You know, I went to school for mechanical engineering for a couple of years. You know.
Did you, how was that for you? Did you enjoy it?
You know, I enjoyed it, but it also involved a lot of, you know, general education courses and all that stuff that kind of deterred me from focusing on anything yeah. engineering related.
Yeah.
And ultimately I just got caught up with work. So you know, I never did finish, yeah. but.
But funny you said that because if I look back to my engineering courses, first and second year, you don't really learn anything specific. It's all the basics.
Exactly.
It's all the general engineering, right?
Yep.
And before that, you got to go through all the math and the physics and all that, all those courses.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Great. You know, textbook stuff. But when you get to the third and fourth year and whatever, that's when you start learning about the, you know, aerodynamic stuff and all the, you know.
And you're like, this is what I've been waiting for from day one.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Why can't they bring it to the first year engineering, you know, students?
Yeah.
You know? Kind of build that interest instead of like giving the general boring stuff.
And I understand that like, you know, certain math classes, you have to have this math class done before you do this. And you need this math class done before you do physics. And I understand all that, but there has to be some sort of way to at least keep the interest alive.
Yeah.
And you know, that's the hardest part. If you're, I think it's crazy to, you know, I'm speaking from my personal experience, but I think it's crazy that we expect kids to be in their late teens and know what they want to do for the rest of their life. And then they get sent off to college.
Right.
I think that's crazy because, you know, that's asking for a lot for somebody who just got through, you know, the time of life in high school with friends and family and all that. And now they're on their own.
Yeah.
And I think that's also why we see a lot of people doing career changes or, you know, they're in their 20s and people are struggling to figure out what they want.
Yeah.
Because they don't know.
Maybe we should have taken a gap year.
Yeah.
After high school.
Yeah. Honestly, you know, you take a year off in high school and, you know, maybe go travel abroad and you see how other people live and you like that.
Yeah.
Or you try a couple different hobbies throughout that year.
Right.
And see which one grabs your interest. And you're like, I'm going to go to school for this.
Right.
You know, but a lot of it is, you know.
Because you have, then you have something to hold on to. And exactly. Because then you have that purpose. You know what you're doing. You know why you're doing it to a certain level, right? Yeah. Instead of just blindly going and enroll as a freshman and, okay, you know, see a student advisor. What courses am I supposed to take if I want to do this and do that? And
exactly. You know, and like I said, like in my situation, like I had parents who did an awesome job of providing for their kids, but they were like, you got to go to college. I'm like, okay, why? What am I going for? And for them, it's like they were so busy providing for us
right.
that they didn't have the answers. And I understand. I don't expect them to know everything. But it's just like, because you just you have to. You're going to learn a lot more in this and that. I'm like, okay, but why am I going to college if I don't know what I want to go for?
Yeah.
Or, you know, what I want to do?
Yeah, and when you're in that boat, it's kind of tough because then if you lose interest and you lose that or whatever you're aiming for, that's it. You're kind of done.
Yeah.
And you're disconnected, you know?
But then on the flip side, I think, you know, you go to college, you get this degree, you're working hard. Then you have some substance behind you with this piece of paper saying, hey, this guy is good at this, X, Y, Z. Then you get, probably a pretty decent paying job out of college. Nothing astronomical, but more money than you've ever had in your entire life, right? From, you know, being a teenager, you know, to your early 20s. As where, on the flip side, I kind of got caught on the B side of, oh, well, you know, I was like working two or three jobs when I was going to college. I'm like, well, why am I going to school if I'm already making money? Not that I was making a lot of money, you know, but you don't know better. It's just, it was still the most money I've ever made in my life at time.
For sure.
So I'm like, I'm making money. I don't need school. You know, then, you know, you a couple of years later, you're like, I should have kept going to school. I would have made more money.
Although these days, not a guarantee.
Yeah. Yeah.
It completely is not. Okay. So you met your friend. What happened then? You know, how, what was that? What was that experience like and how long before you took action to move in that direction?
I would say we ended up actually taking a trip to Japan together with a bunch of friends.
Oh, okay. He was one of them?
He was one of them.
Okay.
Yeah. So we talked prior to going to Japan, but it sparked my interest. We were in Japan. All we talked about was airplanes. And then I would say from when we first met and it sparked my interest to actually taking a flight lesson was 5-6 months.
Okay.
So relatively quick.
That's pretty quick. Yeah.
But also, like I said, you know, when we were talking about it, I was already personally ready for a change.
Mm.
You know, I was going through some personal struggles and all that.
Sure.
And it made me realize that I have a long life ahead as long as I stay healthy and I got to do something fun for the rest of my life. So what is that going to be? So mentally, I was ready for that change. And so, you know, 6 months seems like enough time to, you know, get your affairs in order, figure out what you're going to do financially, how you're going to be able to, you know, get back into like a school program.
Right.
And still pay your bills.
Right.
And do all that.
So if there's somebody listening and, you know, who's interested to becoming a pilot, what were some of the steps that you took? And then what were some of the advice that you would give to them?
I would definitely say it's cliche. If I can do it, anybody can do it.
Why is that?
Because I wasn't a straight A student in high school and I have friends that were straight A students. And if they were that smart and they can grasp any little detail of whatever we were being taught, I don't see why they couldn't excel in aviation.
As long as they want to do it, right?
Exactly. Aviation also isn't for everybody though. You know, there's a physical aspect to it. There's a mental aspect to it. So there's a lot going on. I'm not just talking about airline aviation. I'm talking about flying an airplane in general. You know, like we think everybody can drive a car. Everybody does drive a car. And if you're the worst driver on the road, you're probably driving pretty decent for the most part. But there's another dimension to aviation flying an airplane that can't correlate to driving a car.
The threshold is not...
It's not the same.
You can't be a bad pilot flying any airplane.
Yeah.
You have to have a certain
level of... There are huge consequences for being a poor pilot.
For sure.
You know, you can't just pull over on a cloud when you run out of fuel. Things like that. That's what I like to say. You know, you run out... You neglect your car and it breaks down, you just pull over the side of the road.
Right.
And cars are built so well nowadays that... They don't break down like they used to.
Right.
You know.
Right.
So
what was pilot training like? What was flying school like for you?
For me, I actually really enjoyed it. I kind of missed training. Training was the easy part.
Really?
Yeah. And I don't mean that it was like, you know, a walk in the park. It was easy in that all I had to do was show up, be ready to learn, study on my off time, and rinse and repeat and do it over again. But
how did you learn? Did you have to take notes, or did you take a lot of basically mental notes and just repeating what you do?
I learned what worked for me, and everybody is different, is I learned best if I was handwriting notes and I was listening to somebody instructing. And I took a bunch of different avenues to learn from. I didn't just focus on what my instructor was saying when he was teaching me how to fly airplanes. I did that. I took notes on everything he said so I can always review it. But I was watching videos. I had a bunch of programs. I had books. So I was learning from every way possible. And you know, I'm kind of jumping forward here, but when you become an instructor and you teach people how to fly airplanes yourself, which is what is a common path that people take to get into aviation and become airline pilots, you yourself becoming a teacher in a lot of ways almost become like a psychiatrist. Like, you learn about human behavior and human nature because you have to teach all types of personalities, you know? So I think that was a big factor in it too, that people don't realize.
Right.
So you're learning to adapt a lot as well.
When you learn all these, was it a lot of one-on-one or was it a lot of one-to-a-class kind of instruction?
When I was learning, it was a lot of one-on-one. Okay. Sometimes I meet up with friends and, you know, talk aviation that were more advanced than me or had more experience than I. And this is not even talking about just physically flying the aircraft. This is just groundwork, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, when I was learning, I kind of fell off the face of the earth and I was just eat, sleep, breathe aviation for, you know, all day, every day.
How long did you do that for?
About 2 years.
2 years.
Yeah, two years.
Is that kind of the minimum in ground training?
I wouldn't say it's fast. You know, I wouldn't say it's super slow. It's probably like middle of the pack.
Okay.
There are a couple of different ways you can do it, right? So what I did was I went to a what they call like a Part 61 flight school. Okay. So if you go to like pretty much any airport in Southern California, there's probably a flight school on property. And a Part 61 flight school typically have a curriculum to teach you how to become what they call a private pilot. And the steps to make it to the airlines, you need to become a private pilot. Then you need to get instrument rated. Then you typically become a commercial pilot. You can go a couple different ways after this, but becoming a CFI, which is a certified flight instructor, is common. And then you build hours. Then you're finally getting paid in aviation. You get your multi-engine rating, and then you need hour requirements to fly a jet. So those are kind of the steps of it.
What does instrument rated mean?
Instrument rating allows you to basically fly in weather and through clouds, where you're relying on your instrument panel and your instruments, so you know where you're going rather than just looking out the windows.
Got it.
So I went the Part 61 route, where I found a good flight school with an awesome instructor who went above and beyond to help me. Got all my ratings. They offered me a job at this flight school, and I built my time there. What a lot of people do is you can go to like Part 141 flight schools, which are like a pretty quick strenuous curriculum where you can go from zero flight time to have multiple instructor licenses in 9 months.
Wow.
So, you know, you can expedite and get it done really quick. It's a lot more involved, you know, you're flying every single day for the most part, you know, it's going to cost you more money to go that route. You know, I don't know exactly what the program is for people that go the 141 route or those accelerated programs. They'll definitely get it done faster than I did. They probably spent more money than I did too, though.
I see.
So, or you can, you know, go to a lot of these aviation colleges, and it's a longer footprint to get your flying certificates. Right. You're also getting a 4-year degree with it as well.
Okay.
So it's about 4 years to go from, you know, first flight to becoming an instructor and then teaching at that school.
So there seems to be at least 3 different paths that you can take.
Yeah.
To get
at least,
there,
yeah.
Right? So you took the Part 61
route. Yeah.
Part 61 route. And how did you find that school? Was that recommended by somebody
else? That school was recommended by my good buddy who got me into flying. So the one that I went to high school with him at.
Okay.
This is what made it easy for me. He laid it out. He's like, all right, here's what you're going to do. You're going to fly at this flight school with this instructor. You're going to do your check rides and all your tests with this examiner. You're going to build your flight time, you know, as a CFI. And then when time comes, you're going to apply to the airlines. And maybe because I just had a lot of trust in him and, you know, which I guess could have gone bad if he was steering me the wrong way, but he didn't. He's a great, great guy. I didn't question it. I was like, okay, this is what I got to do. And at that point, you know, I was 2 feet in. I had, you know, failure wasn't an option. Like,
right.
You know, if I'm going to make the jump, I'm going to do it.
So if one were to go into that flight school today,
yeah,
and kind of repeat what you
they
did.
They can do exactly what I did.
They can do exactly the same
100%,
thing.
100%, yeah.
And how much money would it cost them in today's dollars for 2 years of education?
So this is where financially, I'm glad you actually bring this up. It can vary from person to person. And not only can it vary, finding a way to pay for it's hard to do.
Okay.
This is what makes aviation hard to get into.
Okay.
You know, you can go to a college and get a 4-year degree with it. What that would cost, I can't say personally, but I've heard it costing upwards of, you know, well over $100,000 to $250,000 in education with a degree at the end of it. So you're $250,000 in debt potentially.
And it's a longer route.
It's a longer route, yeah. But you do have the college degree backing you behind it, which is awesome. You can probably get some grants and loans to help subsidize some of that, you know, some of that student loan. The Part 91 route can cost more or less than the route that I took. It all depends on how motivated you are. So Part 61 was, you know, a lot of self-study, a lot of self-motivation. Mm. It was me showing up to my flight lessons saying, okay, I'm ready. Let's learn this today. Let's do that today. And my instructor also teaching me. And then he'll be like, okay, we're going to do this tomorrow. Then I'm at home studying it, so I'm ready for it. Part 91 with the accelerated programs are very similar. It's just more condensed.
I see.
You know, it costs more. I see. So if I had to guess what it would cost nowadays to go from like zero experience to like CFI, it also depends on, you know, where you're instructing and you're paying for aircraft and all that per hour. You know, in the States, it could be anywhere from 30, 40,000 to 80,000, wow. You know, Part 91, from what I've heard from some of my buddies, cost more than that.
Okay.
So, but once again, how motivated are you? What are you paying per hour for an aircraft to rent? Cause you're paying for that out of pocket. You know, you're paying for an instructor's time and all that.
Man.
It's okay. Expensive. You know, let's say you fly an airplane, it's $200 an hour.
Yeah.
And to apply for your commercial license, you need 250 hours. And you're not getting paid to fly airplanes yet. You know, you can't get paid to fly airplanes yet. So
out of pocket.
How are you paying $250 at $200 an hour out of pocket?
Right. It's all out of pocket.
So,
yeah.
You know, financially, if you go to like those accelerated programs, they have a loan program.
Okay.
For the most part. You know, and then you finish your training and then you start paying them back.
Okay.
Part 61 isn't like that. You either got to have the money up front and you just pay as you go every lesson, or, you know, you sell a house and a kidney and you make it work. I was able to pull out a business loan from work.
Okay.
So that's where work helped me.
Sure.
You know, yeah. Having a family business and then my business on the side.
Yeah.
I was able to pull out a business loan and help pay for flying.
Yeah. You were a little bit creative with all the financing.
Exactly.
In order to make it and have the funds, right?
Exactly. So I was able to still work on the side a little bit, but a lot less than I did, and just focus on flying full time. As where, you know, if I didn't have that, I would have to find a way to come up with the money. And that would probably involve me working full time and flying on top of that. And if I'm doing that, honestly, I wouldn't have gotten it done in 2 years. It would have taken me much longer.
Have you ever lost motivation or get discouraged throughout the learning journey?
No, okay. I didn't. It's very easy to do so. There's a statistic, they say like 70% of pilots who start their pilot training just to become a private pilot, which anybody can become a private pilot. It allows you to fly recreationally for fun with friends and family, things like that. 70% of people who start don't finish.
Wow.
And you need to become a private pilot to become a commercial pilot later on.
Sure,
so
sure.
It really weeds out the amount of applicants. It's a lot of work.
Private piloting, is that limited to only a certain type of like light aircrafts?
Yeah. So there are a couple different certificates you can get, like recreational pilots, which is even further limiting.
Okay.
But if you become a private pilot, give or take, you can probably fly just about any general aviation aircraft. So any piston engine, single engine,
right?
You know, you can get a multi-engine rating to add on top of that. Then you can fly multi-engine general aviation aircraft. But yeah, I mean, there's a pretty wide array of what it does allow you to fly, at least.
How long did it take you to reach that stage of being a private pilot?
For me, I want to say it was about 8 or 9 months.
8, 9 months.
Okay. Yeah. You know, I had a couple of hiccups along the way, you know, whether it's like making sure you can afford it as you're going through it, you know, the unknowns of the process, you have to get cleared medically to do it.
What does that mean?
You have to get like a medical exam every, depends on what, where you're at in your aviation career. Like I have to do it every 12 calendar months, okay, basically to keep a certain classification of medical.
So it's age specific medical exams.
Yeah. If you're over the age of 40 and you're an airline pilot, it's every 6 months.
Got it.
If you're less than 40, it's every 12 calendar months to keep a first class medical, which allows me to fly for hire airline transport pilot.
Make sure that you're fit to fly, basically. Yeah.
But like, let's say, you know, I was just flying general aviation. My medical certificate would be good for 60 calendar months.
Okay.
But it's a pretty simple check. You know, you have to answer a survey of questions, any broken bones, any history of X, Y, Z, whatever it may be, you know, and then they check your, you know, height, weight, usual stuff at a doctor's office, eyes, ears, things like that. And then you'll get medically cleared.
Okay. And how, you said it took you about 2 years to becoming a...
To be able to finally have like a job in aviation and start getting paid for aviation. So I went from zero flight experience to becoming a certified flight instructor or CFI in 2 years.
So once you're a CFI, once you're cleared as a CFI, you can get paid to fly, basically. Yeah.
And you can actually do it sooner if you get your commercial pilot's license or certificate.
Right.
It does limit kind of your avenues on what you can do for flying for hire. Like you can do traffic watch, banner towing, things like that, pipeline patrol. But I want to become a CFI to teach because if I ever lost my medical, there are different medical requirements for instructors versus airline pilots. I can always resort. It's a backup plan. You know, I can resort back to instructing as well. Yeah.
Okay.
And I think the experience you and knowledge you gain from becoming a teacher in whatever craft it is,
right,
is it's huge, you know. It made me a better pilot teaching people how to fly airplanes because I see the mistakes they make long before they make them. I have to correct them. I have to explain to them how they're doing it right or wrong. And like I said, you're doing that with people of all sorts of personalities, so they're different learning types. And figuring out how can I, you know, relate to this student, but that student is better at reading textbook and understanding where, you know, my other student here learns from making mistakes. My other student here learns from observation of watching me fly the airplane so they know how to fly it.
Right, right. So everybody's different.
Exactly.
Yeah, everybody has different strengths and weaknesses. So.
Exactly.
So what was your first paying aviation job?
My pilot? First was a certified flight instructor.
Okay.
Yep.
How long did you do that for? And
I want to say 3.5 years.
Is it a requirement for you to, when you reach the CFI stage, that you actually instruct before you fly commercially or fly for?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
I have friends who got their CFI certificate and never instructed. They got it and then they got a job doing something else.
Okay.
For me at the time, it seemed like it was going to be, you know, more of a learning experience on my end that I wanted. I wanted to become a better pilot. I was kind of selfish. Sure. I want to get better at my craft.
Yeah.
So if I can teach them, and if I can teach you something, I have to really understand it and know it. And if I don't know the answer, I have to know where to find it or how to help you find it, you know? So that was me pushing myself to do it. A lot of people do the CFI route, but there are also a fair number of people that don't do it. Mm. You know, teaching isn't for everybody. It's a very involved job, I would say. But
what was the hardest type of student to teach for you?
You know, I got judged a lot when I was a instructor because a lot of people looked at me like I was really young. Ah. And so the older crowd, I had a wide array of 15, 16-year-old students to 60-year-old students, you know.
Right, right.
And it wasn't always, I'm saying the older people, but oftentimes the older people, I think, didn't instill trust in me as their instructor because I was younger than them.
Hmm.
And I got that a fair amount, so... you know, to each his own, I guess, but...
You know, but as a student, they can only get as much as they're willing to learn, in a way.
Yeah.
So they're kind of, like, sabotaging themselves if they have that kind of a...
Mentality. Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, I guess I understand it. You know, we... It's not correct, but we always associate age with experience. And I don't think that's always right, you know? So like we said earlier, you can not have a college degree, but be in the workforce for 20 years and know way more than the gentleman or woman who just got out of, you know, a 4-year or a master's degree.
Right.
And they're ready to go to work.
Right.
So,
okay.
That was a bit of a hurdle sometimes.
Yeah.
And if, you know, if that was the case, we'd either swap instructors and find another instructor that fit their personality better, or, you know, I would have to find another way to try to teach them and instill some confidence in my teachings to them. So, you know, whether that be me explaining my experience in stories and them understanding that I do have experience, or finding a way to relate for them personally and them get to know me as an individual as well.
I can relate to that, man, because my first paying job was teaching English in China.
Wow.
I mean, we're not from China, but I was in China for some language immersion.
Okay.
And actually, as a student, I don't think I was allowed to have a teaching job or any job, any paying job for that matter. But I managed to convince the English, ESL principal to get me hired as a teacher.
Yeah.
And I only managed to teach for a week.
Okay.
Because on the last day that I was teaching, somebody asked me how old I was.
Yeah.
And I was like, and I was too honest with them, right? And they realized that I was like 5 to 8 years their junior.
Yeah.
And so they complained and they said, how can you, you know, let a teenager teach us English? So I can definitely relate to that mentality.
And you know, it's I don't want to say it's all just because it's a pride thing on their end, maybe. I'm sure that plays a big factor.
Could be.
But at the end of the day, if somebody knows more than you, they know more than you. You know, their experience knows no age. So that doesn't matter. But, you know.
Yeah.
So you know how it goes.
If I want to learn something about gaming, I don't ask my wife, I ask my kids.
There you go. Sorry, honey.
That's the truth, though. Okay, so you were a CFI, you were instructing for some time.
Yeah, about 3.5 years.
3.5? Okay.
I had a start date with a regional airline, which it's an airline company, but they fly smaller aircraft.
Okay.
So not like 737s or Airbus stuff.
Right.
And COVID hit.
So, wow. Okay.
So that slowed the industry down, and I did not start at the airlines. So I instructed for another, like, maybe a year.
Okay. So you started with the flying the regional jet.
Yes.
Right before COVID.
Yeah, I actually started flying it after COVID.
Okay.
Yeah, so I started flying an Embraer 170-175. It's about a 76 seat jet.
Yep.
You know, you'll fly them anywhere from Los Angeles to San Francisco or Los Angeles to Austin, Texas. But yeah, you can kind of tell it apart because it's like 2 seats per side as you walk down the alley.
Right. It's a 2-2.
Yep.
Okay. And what was that like? Did you like it? Did you love it?
I enjoyed it.
It
was a very advanced aircraft.
Yeah.
It's a newer generation aircraft, maybe 15 years old or something like that. But
right.
Which is new in aviation.
Right. Absolutely.
But, but it was a great airplane, great company. I flew with amazing people. I enjoy the job. Financially, it's a different time now, but financially, the regionals didn't pay very well. And, you know, major airlines pay more than regional airlines. It's almost like a stepping stone.
Right.
But the industry's ruthless, and you could get stuck at a regional airline for 15, 20 years. You could retire the regional airline because the major airlines aren't hiring, whatever it may be. I did some calculations, and the hard part about the regionals, you know, I would have stayed there longer if I can justify it, but I would have probably made more money working full time at In-N-Out than as an airline pilot.
Flying regionals.
Yeah.
Wow. On a per hour basis, you're talking about.
Now, I'll say annually because my hourly rate might be higher, but we only fly so much.
I get it. I got you. Yeah.
So, okay. You know,
definitely not per hour.
No. A normal 9-to-5 versus how the airlines operate are they're two different animals. So it's tough to compare apples to apples, but annually.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the industry has changed the last couple of years. So now regional pilots are finally getting paid, which is awesome. It's well deserved. You know, if you're responsible for that many people's lives on a flight,
yeah,
you should be able to provide for your family. You know, And that's exactly what happens now. But it wasn't always the case.
Okay. So ERJs.
Yeah, ERJs.
And okay, so you did that. Yeah. COVID hit. You went back to instructing for a little bit?
No, I actually never left instructing when COVID hit.
Oh, you never left.
So I had a class date that canceled it.
Okay.
I kept instructing. COVID was still around, but it lifted. I then got recalled back with the airline. So okay. I started with them.
Right.
I flew with them for about a year and a half.
Okay.
I want to say, give or take.
Yeah.
And then I got on with a legacy airline, major airline. I mentioned to you earlier, but I got on with the Alaska Flying 737s out of Los Angeles.
Okay. These were... So that's quite a shift, right? Because you were flying, you know, E1s, and now you're flying Boeing 737s.
Yep.
How much additional training did you have to do transitioning from the E170s to a 37?
So that's a great question. I'm not sure if a lot of people realize this, but when you fly a jet, every jet requires what we call a type rating.
Okay.
And that involves you going into training for a couple months to get to know the aircraft. And that's, you know, it's broken down into like a number of different tests within. But it's the way that I explain it to like people who don't know aviation is, you know, let's say you drive a Toyota Corolla.
Right.
Right. And you get a license to drive a Toyota Corolla. Then you want to upgrade to the Camry. Guess what? You can't just hop in and drive it. You have to get a license to drive the Camry now.
Right.
And then if you get a license to drive the Toyota Sienna when the time comes or whatever it may be. So every aircraft, for the most part, requires what we call a type rating.
Okay.
So, you know, I got type rating in the Embraer 170, 175, which is the same airplane, it's a couple seat difference.
Right.
And then I have to go to training for a couple months to learn how to fly a 737.
Couple months, okay.
Yeah. So the transition going from a flight instructor to flying a jet is a big jump.
Mm.
You know, you're flying three times fast. I used to fly approaches in a little Cessna at like 90 knots to I'm coming in on final into LAX at like, you know, 130 knots.
Right.
You know, so you're doing everything twice as fast, you know,
right.
Almost. And just
gotta be more alert, gotta be more reactive if something goes wrong.
Exactly.
Okay. So 2 months for your, and was that training by simulation?
Yeah. So, when we start a new training program with an airline or we hop from one airplane to another within an airline, you always go back to training.
Okay.
And so I was in training for a couple of months on the 737, and it's everything from book work and taking written tests to then hopping in the simulator and learning flows on how to operate the airplane, call outs, our emergency procedures and normal operations and different types of approaches we fly into airports.
Okay.
So, it's a lot of training, for sure. I don't think a lot of people understand quite how much training it is.
What do you mean by call-outs? Explain that.
So the goal with the airlines and the way that we operate and the reason why it's so safe today is I fly with different people all the time. So I can fly with you, and I can fly with pilot A, pilot B, pilot C. And we have to be standardized, you know, to a T where if I fly with you and then I fly with him, it's like we've flown together 1,000 times before.
You're person agnostic.
Exactly.
It doesn't matter who.
We have to be able to predict what each other is going to do, and we have to know when to call for it and what's going to do. So, you know, we have like a flow is procedurally certain things I may turn on or off in the aircraft and how I operate it.
Mm.
And there are certain triggers that somebody may say or something might happen that I'm like, okay, I have to do this flow now. I do it. And then callouts would be like, you know, we're coming in on approach. And if I'm not flying, so the captain's flying,
right,
and I'm monitoring,
right,
then I would make certain call outs to make him aware of, you know, our configuration for landing. So he's aware if we're stable and we meet certain criteria to land the aircraft and things like that. So I'm constantly reminding him. And then I might have like a call out for him, and then he would have a response for me.
Okay.
You know, so I'll be like, okay, we're stable. Or, you know, I'll be like 500 and be like stable. So I'm like, okay, he knows what altitude we're at. I know that he's stable and I can verify he's stable by looking at the same instrumentation and his intentions are to land. Then when he's runway in sight, if we're in bad weather, he'll say runway in sight landing. And I'm like, okay, I know his intentions.
Mm.
So there's some back and forth communication between us with.
And that could be, that would be different from aircraft to aircraft.
Aircraft to aircraft, airline to airline. You can be
airline to airline.
Airline to airline.
Wow.
I can fly a 737 for you know, I did for Alaska for, you know, about a year. And then, you know, you can go to United, Delta, American, Southwest, anybody that flies 737s, they can do it completely different. And oh. It's kind of funny how it works, but it's all approved by the FAA on how they operate that airplane.
I see.
So.
I see. Is there, say there's a new airline that's starting out, you know, JetGreen.
Okay.
Do they have to go through an FAA process whereby their piloting standards need to be assessed by the FAA and get approved?
Are you talking about like the company? Or the pilots themselves for
the
that
pilots,
company?
The processes on how the pilots fly that airplane on a new airline.
I can't say for sure because every airline I've been with has been pretty well established.
Gotcha.
But from my understanding, the way it would work is like they would determine what airplanes they're going to purchase for that airline. They would figure out how they're going to fly it. Okay. And for the most part, there is, I believe, already like we call it like SOP, standard operating mm-hmm. procedures, you know, and our flight manuals for that airplane.
Okay.
You know, so there's a standard way to fly that airplane. And then if the company wants, they can come and modify that to their liking. Mm. And, you know, they can make it more restrictive. We're like, oh, we want you to double, triple check this, that, X, Y, Z.
I see.
You know, or, okay. you know, the FAA approved this. That's how we're going to fly it. So it can vary.
But no matter how you fly it or the type of call-out process or flow process.
It's all FAA approved.
It's all FAA approved and you go back to the same general SOP that's been given by the
correct.
Manufacturer.
Okay. Correct.
Okay. So, okay, 737s, more passengers. Was that mentally a little bit more taxing for you because there are more lives involved or it's business as usual?
That was, I guess, business as usual. The way I saw it since I was an instructor is if I'm responsible for one person, it's one person more than me. So whether it's one person or 200 people, I'm responsible.
Right.
Making the jump from the Embraer to the 737 was easier than going from CFI in a Cessna to a jet
okay.
in the Embraer. Because I already know how to fly a jet now. I have that experience. I know how airports operate. I have an idea of how the airline world operates, things like that. The airplane itself, going from the Embraer to the Boeing, the 737 was, I don't mean this in a bad way, but the 737 was more unforgiving than the Embraer.
Mm.
Because now you're flying a heavier airplane,
right.
you know, a faster airplane, things like that. So there's not much room for error, you know.
Is that generally how it is, the bigger the engine gets? And
yeah, I'd say it's all like on a ratio, but yeah. you know, the bigger airplane you fly, the more unforgiving it is. If you're coming into land and you cut the power too soon, the airplane's going to fall out of the sky, you know, things like that. So, but once again, like, you know, you go from flying a 737 to like a Dreamliner or 787, the airplane has so much technology that it does help make your workload easier.
Right.
So those, you know, play a bit of an effect too.
Sure. But, sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. And, okay. So you flew for Alaska. That was just with 37s.
Yes, correct. Okay. We had, Airbus 320s, 321 Neos, things like that. But we were going back to an all Boeing fleet.
Right.
Those Airbus were from a merger with Virgin America.
Virgin America. Yeah, I remember that. Okay. And what was a typical month for you? Because, you know, you may not have a typical week.
Yeah.
So what's a typical month in the life of a pilot?
So a typical month, it can vary. The way we operate is either you're what they call a reserve pilot, so you're on call, kind of like okay. I believe how like nurses are, right? They could be sure. on call for the hospital.
Yeah.
So you can have a reserve line where you're on call, and that guarantees you, you know, maybe 13 days off a month, 12 days off a month, and the rest of the days you're on call for the month. Or you could have a line, or we call it like being a line holder, where you have designated trip that you bid for, saying I want XYZ trips. You get them based in seniority order and you know what you're flying.
Right.
You know, so pros and cons to both. If you're a reserve pilot, you don't know where you're going to go, but you might end up having more than 12 days off at home because they don't call you for work. As we're a line pilot, you know you're flying this. And, you know, I'd say
it's more predictable.
More predictable. So, okay. you know, you'll probably have more days off. You'll probably credit more flight hours, which means you're making more money as well. you know, when I was flying 737s, I like to fly. I fly a lot. I like to work hard.
So you bid a lot.
Yeah, good and bad. My personal life kind of suffered a little bit at the time, but my professional life was great.
Okay.
You know, I would have months where I'd have 15 days off to 8 or 10 days off, you know, probably flying anywhere from 70 hours of flight time a month to 95 hours of flight time a month.
95.
Yeah. And we, the way we operate is like, you know, we, cause we're kind of talking about pay earlier, is like we get paid for flight time only.
Sure.
So as soon as we push back from the gate to when we park,
yeah.
But I can be on a 3-day trip where I'm gone from home for 72 hours and I don't get paid for 72 hours. I get paid for 15 hours, maybe 18 hours.
Yeah. Understood.
Yeah.
Understood. Did you have to commute a lot when you're flying the 37s?
I got very lucky. My entire career, I haven't really had to commute.
Wow.
When I was at a regional, I commuted for a couple months to Denver. With Alaska, I did some commuting up to Seattle for maybe about a month. After that, I was LA-based. I live in Los Angeles, grew up and raised here.
Yeah.
So I haven't had to commute much.
Okay.
Yeah, I got lucky. But they're lifetime commuters. People have been commuting for 30 years.
Wow.
And it could be a commute from Burbank Airport to Las Vegas, or it could be Los Angeles to Chicago.
Right.
And they go to they'll fly to Chicago and start a trip and go to work.
Yeah.
So
you don't get paid for commuting.
You don't get paid for commuting. If you know, you have to make sure you make those flights. You have to have backup plans in case you can't get on that flight or that flight cancels. It's a part-time job in itself for commuting.
Wow.
Yeah.
Hence, it's not for everybody.
Definitely not. You know, if you're a commuter, you know, it's your quality of life, in my opinion, really suffers. If you can live in base, it's a great job. If you can't, if I couldn't live in base and I had to commute for 30 years halfway across the country, I'd reconsider another job.
Okay. What were some, so I understand the lifestyle balance or lack thereof.
Yeah.
But what other surprises did you encounter when you first start flying for an airline? What were some of the things that you maybe didn't expect or didn't foresee that you learned after you started doing it?
I think what surprised me the most is how it seems almost impossible to get one flight out on time successfully. And I say that because there's so many moving pieces. Like people look at pilots as like, you know, we're, you know, the end all be all. We have final say on things. But, you know, there are baggage handlers, there are gate agents, there are flight attendants, passengers. The airplane needs to, if the airplane was late somewhere else,
yeah,
I'm not going out on time. I might even get canceled. My flight might be canceled because my airplane never shows up.
Yeah.
You know, so I think the amount of moving pieces involved really surprised me. And I'm just a speck of dust in the game of aviation. But also the other thing that I'd say surprised me is balancing personal and work life. You know, it sounds glamorous to, you know, go to sleep or, you know, wake up in Los Angeles, go to sleep in Honolulu and spend 24 hours there. But, you know, you don't see friends and family.
Right.
You know, you're not there. If you're doing international flying, if I fly from LA to, like, you know, Japan, Haneda, Narita, and something happens at home, I'm a, you know, 8-10 hour flight away from home.
Right.
You know, so trying to balance work and my personal life, it was more of a struggle. When I was a CFI, I was driving home every night, so it wasn't a big deal. It was almost like a 9-to-5 in some ways. But I think that's kind of the million-dollar goal and question for everybody. It's like, how do I have good quality of life at home with my friends and family and kids if you have them, versus, you know, working and having 8 days off a month, 10 days off a month, and I'm never home. And then, you know, some people could be gone for, depending on what type of airline job you take or if you fly cargo and all that, they could be 2 weeks on.
Mm.
So imagine 2 weeks away from home, how much your life changes if you come back home and next thing you know, your kids just graduated high school last week, but you weren't there.
Right.
You know, so I think finding that work-life balance has been a pretty big surprise for me.
Maybe it's somewhat similar to like some other professions out there, like truck driving.
Mm-hmm.
Like long-haul truck driving, they encounter some similar challenges too with regard to family balance.
Definitely.
And I mean, the way I can relate to your life is like it's almost like being on 60%, 70% business travel all the time.
Yeah.
Out of your working life.
Yeah. Or, you know, imagine you drive to work, correct? So imagine you're driving to work. Standard day is what, 8 hours of work, but you know, you guys have a lot of projects and deadlines to meet. And so instead of you working 8 hours a day, you're working 14 hours a day. So you probably wake up early, drive to work. You don't see the kids in the morning. Wife might drop them off to school or something like that. You're at work. You come back home at night. They're already sleeping. You eat dinner. You go to sleep. You wake up, do it again. That's not good quality of life for a 9 to 5.
Yeah.
That's kind of the equivalent of what we deal with in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And we've had some pretty rough news in 2024 with regard to aviation.
Yeah, it's been a rough year.
I mean, second of
2023, 2024 has been
right.
Been busy.
January 2nd, JAL A350 happened in Haneda.
Yeah.
What went through your mind when you heard about it?
I was very impressed with how the crew handled that. You know, it's going to happen. It's just statistics, right? Like accidents in aviation or driving a car, whatever it may be, these things are going to happen.
Yeah.
But we have to be best prepared to mitigate them and respond to whatever the incident or accident is. And, you know, it was a shame to hear about people losing their lives in that. But I was also very impressed with how Japan Airlines crew were able to successfully evacuate such a large wide-body aircraft. Mm-hmm. And everybody got off board. I think it was like 350, 360 souls. I don't know if that included flight crew or not, but it was a lot of people. And, you know, the fatalities were from, I believe, the Japanese Coast Guard, unfortunately.
Yes. Yeah.
But to evacuate that many people is unbelievable. And I've seen, you know, tons of videos of it on social media where the flight attendants did a great job of getting everybody off, but also keeping them calm and making sure. There's a big thing I see in a ton of evacuation videos. Nobody's carrying a bag.
Right.
In Japan, everybody listened to instructions. They did as they should. They got off. Not a single fatality on the airline.
Yeah.
And that was amazing.
It's both the crew and the passengers.
They
both did the right
exactly.
thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, I understand that like these things can be scary. You know, you see a fire from an engine scraping the ground or the engine's on fire, whatever it may be, but we're trained for all this stuff. Like we not only are we trained for it, we have to go to recurrent training every so often to make sure we still know this stuff and we demonstrate that we can do it proficiently.
Let me ask you this. If that were to happen when you're flying an aircraft into Haneda,
mm-hmm.
and I mean, you would feel that the plane just struck something upon landing, and then you land it, you have to evacuate. Are there sensors that tell the cockpit crew,
like something's going
where on, fires are erupting, which engine is blowing up, and stuff like that?
Definitely. So I don't know about that incident specifically, but just in general, like if we have like an engine fire, we get an indication. And we have multiple sensors per engine in case one. Everything in aviation is redundancy.
Okay.
You know, so we could have like two sensors in one engine, two sensors in another engine. So that way we know there's a fire in the left engine, but not the right. We'll get an indication. We follow checklists. You know, we have certain procedures. And we have memory items as well where I have to memorize. If this happens, I know to do X, Y, Z.
Right.
And I got to do it. And, you know, captain's going to have his stuff and whatever it may be. So I'm sure they had some sort of indication. You're also in a very crucial part of the flight phase of landing where, you know, you got to figure out, I know we're dealing with the fire, but we're on the ground, you know, so let's get this airplane stopped. Then we'll fight the fire. And fires are scary, but we do have some leeway with time on how we're going to fight a fire. We have fire suppression bottles to shoot into the engines, multiple of them for the most part. Right. So fighting fires are scary, but it's not the end of the world. But I can understand as a passenger, you don't understand the training that we go through to prepare for these things. And if I was a passenger and I didn't know anything about aviation, I saw a fire, I would think my life is flashing before my eyes and I want to get off.
Yeah.
You know. But once again, flight crew is trained for this stuff and, you know, they know how to get us out successfully.
You got to understand and just follow the sequence of operations, sequence of 100%. Events, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Not all 361 passengers should just get up of their seat and crowd the aisles, for example. And
yeah, you can watch tons of demonstration videos of like, you know, when all these airplanes get certified, they need to be certified to evacuate however many people they have on board in a certain time frame
right.
to pass a FAA certification.
Right.
And, you know, oftentimes in evacuations, there are tons of injuries. broken bones, whatever it may be, you know, people grabbing their bags, and next thing you know, like, four people can't get off the airplane because everybody's taking 5 seconds a person to get whatever it may be.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's just no room for that. Like, human life is priceless, but, you know, your $4,000, you know, computer in your bag, not a big deal. Yeah. We'll get that figured out. So I think they did an amazing job on that, honestly.
Right.
But yeah, that was pretty unfortunate to hear.
Right. And the flight crew has to know which door should they be evacuating.
Yeah.
Exiting.
So
from.
We do communicate with the flight attendants.
Okay.
For the most part, they do, and this can vary from company to company, but, you know, if they were to initiate an evacuation from their information that we don't have, which could happen, I'm not going to fight it. They might start evacuating. They'll give me a call saying, hey, we're evacuating. Boom, I'm running into a different checklist to evacuate the aircraft, and me and the captain are focusing on something else, making sure the engines are shut off so nobody runs into an engine that's on, or, you know, if there's a fire, we're fighting that fire so people don't get burned, whatever it may be.
Right. So at that time, when the pilots landed the plane, and as soon as they successfully landed, they stopped the plane, all the comms are just between the cockpit and the flight attendants. I mean, there's no ATC involvement anymore
ATC is involved in that as well. So
they are? Okay. How so?
You know, their situation, is, once again, it's tough to say. I'm sure ATC was involved. Oftentimes, I could, you know, if I was in that situation, ATC could say, hey, you know, we've seen an engine on fire. We saw an explosion.
Oh, okay.
We're aware of it.
Right.
I don't know what they were or were not aware of, but ATC would notify that thing. If we're landing and we're expecting a fire and we're coming in on approach, ATC would already know, hey, we're an emergency aircraft. There's a fire. You know, if we're landing and then we get a fire indication, I let ATC know right away, hey, you know, fire, we're stopping on this runway. Send crash fire rescue.
Right.
You know, so that way we have it all set up in place. And there's so much that goes on with that stuff, and like determining if we're going to pull off the runway, stay on the runway, where we're going to point the aircraft in terms of where the wind is to spread the fire, or help suppress feeding the fire, things like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, ATC is a huge help for that.
Okay. So what other aircrafts have you flown commercially?
So I enjoyed my time flying the 737 at Alaska Airlines. Very iconic aircraft in aviation, so I was excited to fly it. But
by the way, does Alaska still give out free beer for everybody? Do you know?
The pilots don't get it, so I can't say.
not you guys.
Was that a thing? I don't know.
That was a thing for the whole cabin, all classes.
I don't think that happens
free
anymore.
Free booze.
Really? I know if you're first class, I believe like premium. I forgot what they call it exactly, like premium economy.
Yeah,
or economy plus.
No, they used to give it to like everybody.
No.
Economy.
No.
Really?
Not that I know of. Yeah. But aviation's changed a lot in the last, you know, 10, 15, 20 years.
Yeah.
You know, with everything from 9/11 to happening to making things strict. Like,
yes.
You used to be able to, if you're going to drop your kids and your wife off at the airport, walk them to the gate to the airplane. You can't do anything like that anymore from TSA and security reasons.
Right.
So, yeah, it's changed a little bit, but.
You need to buy a boarding pass and then cancel it right away.
Yeah. Hopefully you get a refund. Hopefully you get a refund.
No, you'll get a credit. You'll get a credit good for 12 months.
There you go.
Okay. So 737s. You enjoyed that.
Yeah. I made the jump to United Airlines last year.
Okay.
After flying 737. Just wanted a little bit of a change. I'm fortunate enough that all these airlines still fly out of Los Angeles, and I live in Los Angeles.
Right.
Don't really plan on leaving. So, you know, I can do that. But I made the jump to United. I now fly 757s and 767s for United.
Okay. So that's your first wide body for the
767s. Yeah, the 767s. Yeah. So what's interesting about this fleet is these are, you know, older aircraft that were certified in the late 70s and all that stuff. But I think Boeing convinced the FAA that it's essentially the same airplane, and the cockpit is very similar. Minus maybe some changes with, you know, where certain things are, certain displays. But like how I was telling you earlier, you need a type rating for aircraft. If you get typed in a 757, you're also typed in a 767.
Really?
So it goes both ways. So,
okay.
I've flown 767s, you know, across the Atlantic to Zurich, Switzerland, or, you know, London, England, things like that. And I fly 757s domestically from Los Angeles to Newark to, you know, Chicago, wherever it may be.
Right. Okay, so more variety.
More variety, ultimately, was I genuinely enjoyed my time in Alaska. I can't say a single bad thing about the airline. I think they operate great, amazing people. You know, they have a great thing going for them. But, you know, I have over 30-plus years in the aviation career still. And I didn't want to limit myself to flying one airplane. It gave me a variety to fly different airplanes if I want, which opens up the variety of different routes, whether I want to do international or domestic, things like that. So I made the jump.
Okay. Just a quick segue. You mentioned when you were instructing students who wanted to fly that sometimes they see that you're young and things like that. Do you have the same problem now? Because you still look young.
Yeah.
As a commercial pilot.
I would say almost every flight that I operate, somebody asks me how old I am. I get that all the time.
Somebody...
A passenger. Passengers always ask how old I am. Or, you know, I'll be walking through the terminal, I hear, like, comments from people walking by me, like, oh, he looks so young, or, you know, whatever it may be. I'm like, I'm probably older than, you know, your eldest children who are in college, you know? So, it's pretty funny. I play along with it, but you have to be at least 21 years old to fly a jet for the airlines.
Okay.
I'm at least 21 years old. Yeah. It's very young. It's very I know. Young. Yeah. Those are the kids that are, you know, die hard. They knew what they wanted since they were five and they grew up at the local airport watching airplanes over their head.
Wow.
I wish I had that story. There's a lot of that. It's an amazing story. You know, it's not mine, but yeah, it's incredible to be that young and be an airline pilot.
So you still get that?
These days. I get that all the time.
Really?
Yeah. So,
but in good spirits though. I mean, most people kind of ask you.
Yeah.
Or do they look concerned when they ask you that?
It doesn't seem as judgy, I guess. a lot of it is like, oh, how old are you? Oh, that's awesome. When did you start flying? Things like that.
Okay.
You know, maybe they don't say it to my face and they might feel maybe uncomfortable, but oftentimes, like, you know, I'm a first officer. Captains are always older. So they're like, oh, he has somebody to learn from or somebody that's more experienced, whatever it may be. And there's a lot of truth in that. Mm. So maybe that kind of lessens their anxiety of seeing somebody who looks really young, you know, walking out of the cockpit or something. So that might play a factor, but yeah, I get that a lot.
Right. Wow. I mean, we talk about JAL. I mean, that was really unfortunate because when I heard about that, I knew that, those guys have a pretty solid track record of safety.
Yeah.
Right. And, like you said, it's statistics.
Yeah.
Things, when you fly so many million times, things are bound to happen, you know, every few million times.
Yeah.
And it just so happened at Haneda to Japan Airlines.
I heard, and I don't mean to cut you off, but I heard a very interesting statistic that really opened up my eyes. And it was when I was in training at United. United has, I don't know how many departures a day, you know, across the US or international, but hundreds of flights a day, right?
Yeah.
And the statistic that I heard was, if we were successful 99.9999% of the time, we'd have a crash every couple of days.
Wow.
That's how many flights we have. So we can't afford to have a track record of being that safe and successful. It needs to be nearly perfect. You know what I mean? So when you think about it that way, you're like, okay, yeah, the safety is no joke.
Right, right. But things still happen, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Alaska 1282, I think it was like 3 days later.
Yeah.
After the JAL incident happened from PDX to Ontario.
Mm-hmm.
So I think 6 minutes into the flight when they're at about 16,000 elevation, there was a flight incident.
Yeah.
Where one of the left side door plugs basically came out and the flight crew made a quick emergency descent into 10,000 feet.
Yeah.
That was a tough one.
That was. We do train that, and that specific incident, we do have like memory items that we need to know, because, you know, loss of pressurization in the cabin is a huge deal. And, you know, fortunately it was 16,000 feet. If that happened at 36,000 feet, we'd probably be talking about maybe a fatality at minimum, you know. But we have memory items that we do, and the flight crew sounds like they did an awesome job of doing those memory items, getting our oxygen masks on, so that way we know we're safe and we can operate the airplane now.
Right.
And then descend, you know, get to a lower altitude. But yeah, that was very scary. The crew did a great job of handling that, and fortunately there were, you know, no issues. I heard that, you know, there was a child's shirt that got ripped off. I've seen pictures of cell phones that survived a 16,000 foot fall with the charger still plugged in, but the cords ripped and all sorts of craziness.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, the 737 has been around for a very long time and it's a very safe airplane. I had a captain tell me that flying on a Boeing is the second safest form of transportation in the world.
Okay.
Take a guess on what number one is.
Okay, I won't.
Escalators.
Oh, is number one. Not what I was thinking.
kind of an interesting statistic, but I mean, Boeings have been flying for decades, you know, and
yeah.
They're definitely safe. It's just, you know, an unfortunate incident.
Yeah, they have to be safe.
Have to be, yeah.
I mean, there's, like you said, 0.9999 is not good enough. Yeah. During the incident, there was a decompression event, and that led to the cockpit door opening up. I mean, I think it's part of the design of the aircraft itself.
Did it? I wasn't aware of that.
It did fly open, basically.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, that's, I think, a requirement to equalize the pressure within the cabin, something to that effect. But that could have been a sticky situation as well, because you're trying to commandeer the airplane. You're trying to descend to 10,000 feet.
Yeah.
And, I mean, just, there's a lot of multitasking, isn't it, in flying an airplane, especially in an emergency situation like that.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, when we have emergency situations go on, and this is why we spend so much time in simulators and we always go to recurrent training, you know, there's a chance that in that company's training footprint, they're going to put more emphasis on cabin depressurizations just to make sure you're fresh with it in case it happens again. All these companies, you know, they learn from their mistakes and they improve and they put emphasis on them, which is what makes it so safe. I think we haven't had like a casualty on airline soil in aviation in like almost 10 years. And there was that one incident, I believe it's like the Southwest depressurization.
Yeah, it was also
5 years ago, six years ago, whatever it was.
Yeah.
And I believe that person passed away, unfortunately, but it was I think at the hospital, not from the actual incident.
Right.
So we have a very safe track record in the States, but I mean, the multitasking involved is, you know, it's in the cockpit, us determining who's going to fly the airplane, who's going to handle all the operations. And, you know, like, let's say I'm flying the airplane. I got to get the airplane down. I have my oxygen mask on. You know, we got flight attendants calling. We got to make sure that everybody's okay.
Right.
They're aware of what we're doing. Captain's letting the company know what happened. ETC has to know. We're coming in for an approach that we weren't prepared for because now we're diverting to, you know, like Portland.
Yeah.
So you're going back to where you came from.
Yes.
You know, you're reprogramming the aircraft while you're flying it and handling radios. It's busy.
Busy yeah. work.
Definitely.
For good reason, because there are lives.
Well, lives at stake. Yeah.
But you never shy away from that challenge.
No, you know, you accept it, and I think what kind of makes this job fun is it forces you to be better. You know, there's things are always changing. You got to know your stuff inside and out, and you just got to be prepared for it. You know, so I have certain things that I do that I try to go above and beyond company policy and procedure on how we operate the airplane. So, you know, it's like I check my cabin pressure altitude at 10,000 feet and then 20 and then 30. And if it's not looking right, you know, the airplane will alert us.
Right.
But I'm also aware of it myself, maybe even before the airplane knows. Things like that. So just trying to be prepared. But in this job, you can't get comfortable and complacent. You know, it forces you to do a lot of review on your days or time off or in flight. You're constantly reviewing, you know, revisions to how we operate the airplane or making sure you know how to do it.
Right.
Yeah.
Another segue, just different aircraft types. You know, smaller aircrafts, I think, fly at the lower altitude, like private jets.
Private jets, like let's say you rent a jet to go from here to Hawaii, actually flies, depending on the airplane, could be flying higher than what the airlines fly.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Could be into like the 50,000 foot range.
What's the, who determines that? And are there reasons on such
decisions? Yeah, so that would, the aircraft certification process would determine how fly the airplane, or how high the airplane can fly.
Right.
The airline world, we cruise about the 30s. 30,000 foot range, give or take.
Yeah.
We can change altitude depending on fuel burn for wind conditions. So if we have a headwind at, say, 36,000 feet, but at 38,000 feet is calm winds, we might climb up another 2,000 feet because now we don't have a headwind fighting us. So we get to our destination faster. Also burning less fuel now, things like being more economically friendly and fuel efficient.
But you need permission. Anytime you decide to change course, you need permission.
Exactly. So ATC's, the way we flight plan is like, imagine you're on, you know, Google and you're saying, I'm going to go from, you know, my house to Las Vegas. And it's showing you, I'm going to take this freeway and that freeway, that exit. Imagine you send that to somebody who's reviewing all the cars in the area that are driving to Las Vegas. Then they know exactly where you're going, what time you're going to be on the freeway, what time you're getting off the freeway. It's all observed. Everything we do. So if we need to make changes, we have to notify air traffic controllers, like, hey, we want to climb 2,000 feet. And that may or may not happen. They might say, you know, like if we're planning on cruising at 36,000 feet, but we want 38,000 feet for a better ride, for less turbulence, we can request it. But there might be an airplane right above us at 38,000 feet.
Okay.
So we're all, you know, above 29,000 feet, we're all separated by about 2,000 feet. So depending on flow of traffic and things like that. But same direction traffic, 2,000 for separation.
Turbulence management, large aircraft, small aircraft, is there a difference between?
It's the large aircraft handle it better.
Handle it better.
They don't get beat up as bad in turbulence for the most part. So
if I want to fly to Honolulu from LAX,
the bigger the airplane, the better.
versus like an A321, you know?
You'd be fine in either, to be honest.
Really?
For the most part, yeah. I wouldn't see. It's not probably as much of a difference, especially for passengers.
Right.
I just know from flying a smaller airplane, you know, what an Embraer 175 reports as moderate turbulence is light turbulence for a 737.
Oh, okay.
You know, it's less susceptible to as much movement in the air with that much mass.
Okay. Yeah. Makes sense. It's all physics.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. What's next for you? Like, if you look at 10 years down the road, where do you see yourself?
It's a good question. You mean like in the aviation world, in the personal world?
Or a little Let's bit start aviation.
Aviation. In the aviation world, I would say I have a couple options. Either I continue as a first officer on the airplane I'm flying on, at 757, or I switch airplanes.
Okay.
You know, you become what they call like a senior first officer, so you get a better schedule, a little bit more flexibility, maybe some more days off. You can cherry pick the trips you want.
Right.
So if I want to fly Honolulu every month, I can do that.
Right.
Versus flying like, you know, continental US. Upgrading to captain is kind of intriguing because left seat comes more responsibility, but more pay.
Okay.
So I guess we'll see where we're at financially in my personal life and determine if that's the jump to make.
Right.
Or, you know, I can change fleets and maybe go fly wide bodies and do international flying as a first officer. Captains on wide bodies takes a number of years to achieve to be able to be eligible to sit in that seat because it's all seniority based company wide.
Okay.
So there's a lot of people that probably want it before I do. But
so do you think there is a, do you think it's mentally more taxing to fly on the left seat? Or do you think that, I mean, they're equally they're equally responsible to make sure
I think safety is... a lot of people don't realize. I get this question from people sometimes is like, you know, what do I do as a first officer or a co-pilot?
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing. I do the exact same job a captain does. You know, if I'm, you know, we delegate duties, and if I'm pilot flying, I'm flying the aircraft, I'm taking off, I'm landing, I'm operating it. If I'm monitoring, I'm doing the radios, and he's physically flying the airplane.
Right.
You know, we delegate those duties.
Either of you can do the job, right?
Exactly. And, you know, if the big thing about being PIC, pilot in command, or captain of an aircraft is you have final authority. So if you're my captain and we're flying, you know, we're going to operate and mesh well together because of our company policies and procedures. We might, good captains will say, hey, what do you think about this thunderstorm or weather's looking bad in Chicago? What do you think? And they would include, you know, their crew members with the decision-making process. But ultimately, captain has final authority. So if captain's like, if I say, oh, Chicago looks good, and I don't know any better, I'm like, oh, we're going to land, weather's great, and it's not, then he's going to be like, yeah, we're not going to Chicago. We're going somewhere else. You know what I mean? You know, so, but they do have final authority on how we operate the airplane, you know, what's going to happen if we're legal to depart due to maintenance issues or regulatory rules that we have, whatever it might be. So, yeah, it's definitely, it's taxing regardless, but captains work hard for their money. Right. They work hard for their money. And, you know, they have a lot of experience to back it up, so.
So each airline has a certain experience level or criteria before you're allowed to
like go for upgrade, that role?
Yeah.
Upgrade? Yeah, so there's certain hour requirements for the most part to get on with an airline in general. You know, like to fly a jet, you need at least 1,500 hours of flight time total.
Right.
You know, there are other things within that, but you need at least that flight time, you know, and, you know.
To have a first paying commercial airline pilot job.
Yeah. And that's if the airlines will hire you at 1,500 hours.
Right.
They might not. They might want to see 2,500 hours, you know. So.
That's in the U.S.
That's in the U.S., yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Other countries might be
could be different. Correct.
Okay.
Like you can fly a jet in Europe with a lot less hours.
Why do you think that is?
They just operate differently. Mm. You sit in the right seat longer before you get to the left seat, things like that.
Yeah.
I don't know the exact details on why. I think it's just a different way on how they operate. And it works for them, it seems like. So.
Right, right.
But, you know, more experience isn't necessarily a bad thing, so I'm not mad about how we do it here. So, yeah.
Any... Okay, so that's professional. Personal life?
Personal life is tough.
Anything that you want to share?
You know, I think I'm still... I spent so much time the last couple of years chasing the professional life.
Okay.
That I've kind of neglected the personal life.
Gotcha.
So I'm kind of...
just you and me here.
Yeah. Thank God. So I'm still kind of trying to figure that out.
Sure.
Now that I have achieved all the goals professionally of like making it to an airline where, you know, I'm going to retire, I'm not going anywhere, things like that. I've kind of started focusing back on what I want in my personal life, you know, and, you know, we've been trying to figure out if we want kids, if we're going to have kids, if we're going to stay in California, if I can focus more on some of my hobbies, things like that. So, not exactly sure yet, but hopefully in 10 years, I'm going to be in a good spot.
Yeah.
That's all I know so far. That's what I'm hoping.
What are some other advice you would want to give to, you know, the younger crowd, younger generation who might be interested to do what you do?
I would say stick to it.
Stick to it.
Yeah. You know, it isn't for everybody, but if you have a strong work ethic, that can overcome a lot of struggles in life. And that's life in general, not just aviation, right? But sticking to it, you know, I have a lot of students that I instructed and I still keep in communication with. And there, some of them are at the airline. Some of them are about to make it to the airlines. Some of them just fly for fun.
Wow.
It's all, you know, different degrees on whatever you want to do, which is awesome.
Yeah.
But the big thing is sticking to it. You know, it's consistency. It's just like going to college and getting a 4-year degree. You don't, you know, you get to year 3, you know, you're almost finishing up year 4 and you stop and you have nothing to show for it.
Right.
You know, so, persistency is probably the hardest part, being very persistent with it. And of course that comes with its own struggles of the financial backing and having the time and, you know, also understanding what you're getting yourself into. I kind of talked about like quality of life and how, you know, I could be gone for a couple, I could be home for 24 hours, you know, once a week if I want to, if I work really hard.
Yeah.
You know, my life here is horrible. I come back home to completely different problems than when I left in my personal life because so much time has passed. But understanding what you're getting yourself into and realizing that, you know, we're not designed to spend so much time away from our loved ones. So you have to know how to manage that. That's kind of been a big eye opener for me.
I think as a pilot, that's a big thing.
Yeah.
And you got to be able to manage that. You got to be able to set the right expectations
exactly.
for everybody around you.
Yeah. And you know, the people, you know, your loved ones and friends and family will understand, you know, the sacrifices and hopefully support you in it. And that just means that you have to return that favor when you can.
Right. Well, it's been a very interesting pivot story for your journey, Sean.
A little bit of a change.
Yeah. You know, from your high school days and, you know, being interested in cars and racing to eventually pivoting to become a pilot and, you know, flying full time now as a commercial pilot. It's definitely fascinating. It's definitely a world that, you know, I haven't experienced myself and I'm so blessed to have this conversation with you today. So likewise. Definitely thank you for your time. And yeah, thank stay you. Safe, stay engaged as a pilot. And I'd love to have you back sometime in the future.
Yeah, just let me know. And I appreciate the conversation. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on. Thanks a lot, Sean.
Thank you.